My name is John Schramm, and we are in the fourth session this week of a series of discussions together called Gentle Justice, needs an L in it, Toward a Healthy Spirituality. And today I gave it a title, The New Monasticism, or A New Monasticism. I'd like to review just a little bit. Most of you, I think, have been to some session, but I don't think it will be an insult for you to review. We've taken a word, spirituality, which is somewhat new and faddish among Protestantism. I've already told you that there is some negative baggage to that for me, that it's used sometimes to cover things or be a subject where we can now talk about something new when you really don't have much to say. But I hope it becomes for us a richer word while we're here. Every spirituality has a center. And I think that we begin to understand one another better when we understand where the center is. The first day I gave some possible centers. I don't know whether that's the best list or not. If the center of your spirituality is going to heaven after you die, if that's the primary understanding of what it means to be saved or salvation, that's quite late in Christian history, by the way, to have that understanding of it. You will begin to know as people talk about the faith, you'll get a good sense of where the center for that is. If salvation, on the other hand, is the name for Jesus, Jehoshua, means space giver. Mm-hmm. If the idea for salvation is space, you will better understand why some people call their theology liberation-centered theology. that's not especially new or politically left. It has some deep roots in the Hebrew word of salvation. But you'll probably know where they're coming from. You'll probably know where the center of their spirituality is. I think it's fairly easy to see some people's spirituality centers in a particular religious experience. And you really aren't into that spirituality until you've imitated that particular experience. Or a particular piety, devotion to particular behavior or rituals. And I said, and I hope it didn't sound facetious, I think Lutheranism, by and large, has a center of right doctrine. And I think that has something to offer to the church, but I think it also means, if that's the center, that you'll know that pretty clearly when you're with a group of Lutherans, and that we have some things to learn from other people who don't have that same center. We are, for 2 weeks, taking a center of gentle justice, which is the theme for Holden for the summer. In other words, what would it do to spirituality if the very center of it was nonviolent, active, reconciling nonviolence as the center of our spirituality? That doesn't mean that's the entire spirituality, but it gives us a kind of place that we keep coming back to. It would be a way to understand why the first Christians were called followers of the way. They were not called believers in a particular doctrine, or those who behave with a certain pattern, or those who have certain feelings. It was called followers of the way. And I think if you study the New Testament, that primarily had to do with a distinctiveness in regard to nonviolence and a distinctiveness in regard to servanthood that replaced domination, and a radical forgiveness that absorbed suffering. Followers of the way was the reason people could say, see how they love one another. It was a distinctive mark of the early Christian church. Anyway, that's what we're testing for a while. On the circle outside, we've had 4 points, and we keep coming down on one of them. We keep connecting them in all kinds of directions, and the sessions have centered more in one of these places of the circle, always coming back to gentle justice. The first one, we started with Jesus as the norm. We started with living word, tied in very much with Mary's first session this week, where Luther did not put an equal sign between word and Bible. He did put an equal sign between word and incarnate word, Jesus. He also put an equal sign, or almost an equal sign, between word and grace, word and promise, but never between word and Bible. And that comes as a great shock sometimes to Lutherans. And I think sometimes people enjoy shocking more than they enjoy conversation, and I hope that's not the case. I remember a seminary professor that I really loved, and you knew he loved God's Word. He was not a smart aleck. And he started a session of biblical study in the New Testament by taking a Bible, throwing it on the floor, stepping on it, and saying, "That's what I think of the Bible. But I would give my life for the Word of God." And we had one of the most inspiring, faith-inspiring hours I've ever had with another human being. Well, one of my classmates tried that on internship. He never even got to finish. He didn't even get to say, "But I'd give my life for the Word of God." There was such an uproar. It's like visiting a 98-year-old saint, bringing her Holy Communion, and talking against the Moses authoring the first five books of the Bible. It's just stupid sometimes. But it seems to me that there is the possibility for growth when you come to Holden if there's a respectful sharing about the ferment that goes on in the faith. And one of those, I think, is a lively discussion in the church today about what is the Word? What is the Word of God? Not only among denominations, but even within Lutheranism. It's one of our places of tension. And I just wish there were more places where we could talk about it. You know that my assumption is that a healthy spirituality is in the world, not an escape from it or a retreat from it. Tomorrow we will take as the key thing why it's important that it's in community. And yesterday we spent almost all the time on solitude. You probably know that in the history of the Christian church, there was one place where spirituality was taken very seriously, and that was in the monastery. So what we're going to do today is to say, given this possibility of spirituality, how does monasticism come off? I'm going to assume a negative reaction when I say monasticism from you. I'm going to assume that because most of us come from a tradition where we found our freedom historically when someone like Martin Luther left a monastery and an order, in order to find the freedom of the gospel. I'm assuming you're going to think of cloistered, celibate, hiding from the world, gazing at your own spiritual life instead of ministering to the needs of the world, legalism, asceticism, are those words you know, denying God is the giver of every good and perfect thing. I'm going to assume a kind of negative reaction to the word monastic, not only from those who are Protestants, but probably from those who are Roman Catholics and have seen maybe the worst of what happens with religious orders. Most of the religious orders are in tremendous renewal these days. Just visit one, and especially since John the 23rd and some reforms in the Roman Catholic Church, and they are leaving some of the things, distinctive garb and what have you. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But what I would like to do is to say, can we learn about spirituality and these points that we've called important? Can we learn some things from monasticism historically? And is there emerging something that I'm calling a new monasticism? I'm not so interested in medieval forms being superimposed upon the U.S. today, especially upon Protestant church today. I am interested in what we call the monastic heart. I am interested in what the essence of monasticism was. This was confirmed for me, my interest in this, recently, by a writer named Robert Wilkin. He's a distinguished scholar of early Christianity, Commonwealth professor at the University of Virginia. For 20 years, however, he taught at Fordham, St. Mary's, and Notre Dame. For 20 years, a Lutheran taught in Roman Catholic institutions. So he was asked, "What did you learn? How have your years among Roman Catholics changed your understanding of what it means to be a Lutheran Christian?" Here's his answer. The most obvious answer is the best answer. If the Reformation is not remembered and celebrated by evangelical Christians, it will be forgotten. This is not to say that the Reformation is ignored in Roman Catholic colleges and seminaries, although Notre Dame's theology department had no Reformation scholar, nor that contact with evangelicals has not disposed Roman Catholics to aspects of the Christian tradition that Lutherans learned during the Reformation, but that for Roman Catholics, the Reformation is not part of their communal memory. And he thinks that's an important part for the Church Catholic, not Roman Catholic, for the Church Catholic or universal, and we should bring that. Then he says this. In the course of the Reformation and its aftermath, however, something important was lost. If I were to name one thing that is wanting among us, it would not be the papacy, nor bishops, real ones that is, but the quiet testimony of monks and nuns. This is a great privation. At one time I thought the restoration of monastic life was necessary on pragmatic grounds, that monasticism with its requirement of celibacy could provide men and women for exceptional ministries in the inner city, in foreign lands. Now, after my years among Roman Catholics and a firmer grasp of Christian history, I realize that the demise of monastic life in the Reformation churches is a profoundly spiritual loss. The texture of our communal life is less rich, less nuanced, because we do not have monks and nuns as spiritual guides and models, counselors and friends, nor do we have monasteries, religious houses to which we can retreat for prayer, solitude, spiritual refreshment. The monastic life serves the church simply by exhibiting another way of being a Christian, by offering possibilities that do not conform to the conventional patterns of our society. Because we lack the unassuming presence of men and women who submit themselves to a spiritual discipline, for whom prayer is part of their daily routine, meditation an essential component of their everyday life, our vision of the Christian life is severely constricted. If I have one prayer for American Lutheranism, it is that God will raise up among us men and women to serve in religious communities, and that Lutherans will be hospitable to such stirrings of the Holy Spirit. That came as an affirmation to me, because you now will know if you have one of these, and there are others on this table that maybe you could put to the second row of the kitchen. You will know, if you look at this, what I've been up to for 2 years. I had the same hunch, and it developed over a long period of time for me. I had the same hunch that Protestantism was poorer for not having religious orders. At first, I thought, if you go into a group of Protestant people and say, is Protestantism poor for not having religious orders, the first answer will undoubtedly be, no way. No way. Who needs religious orders? We've got all kinds of freedom. Are you interested in peace? Join Lutheran Peace Fellowship. You don't have to ask the Pope. It doesn't have to come under canonical law. You don't have to have all of that stuff that goes with it. It's not encrusted with all kinds of definitions. Just start it. In fact, if there are three or four of you and there's not a denomination that suits you, start a new one. We have thought that the essence of our tradition is our freedom. And I think we would think of religious orders not as a new richness, but as a poverty compared to what we now have. I want you to at least be challenged a little bit to rethink some of that. And I hope some of the things in this paper do that. I think we're poor for not having religious orders. So what I'd like to do today, this is a little different from the other time, what I'd like to do today, it'll feel like you're back in school, I'd like to open up a few of the comments of this, let you have this for reading it further, then I don't feel I have to read it to you. And I want to do that in three categories and then leave time for our discussion. I would like, instead of giving you a long history and all of the definitions of a religious order, I would like to take this box first that says six basic characteristics of religious orders and use that at least for the present situation today to describe what we're talking about. Those are my six. So they certainly can be challenged by scholars, but it seems to me I've tested it with enough people who are in religious orders that I think they're okay for us to work with. First, religious orders emerged as a renewal or a protest movement. They came out of a counterculture. They came out of times when the church existed and was too enculturated. And so some people said, for Christ's sake, we have to be more distinctive. We have to be peculiar people. We have to be light and leaven and what have you. In other words, I would not be interested in starting religious orders in Namibia. The church is not enculturated in Namibia. The church is oppressed and understands itself as a distinctive people. I am saying, is it possible that the church is too enculturated in the United States and it's a time for an order? I think that's a valid question, but I don't think I would be asking that question if I happened to live somewhere else. Probably, religious orders will not emerge where the church is persecuted. There will be ferment for them in a place where the church might be seduced. That would be the difference. And that will be up to the people of whether or not you feel that there is a time for renewal that includes being dissident. Dissident means dissidari. I don't sit with you at the table. Doesn't mean you leave the room. It means there's a time for a distinctiveness at this point. Two, they each had a particular focus. If I understand the rule of St. Benedict, and this would be a great conversation with Elmer Witt, who doesn't like the word balance. I love the word balance. I just didn't want to get the forum off of the obvious topic last night and start discussing balance. But anyway, I think balance is a very much part of the Benedictine rule, and it was a way to create something of a healthy life in the midst of chaos. So it was a rhythm of work, worship, study, play, prayer. It had a nice harmony to it. Sister Marie Augusta Neal, a school sister in Notre Dame, got off the bus, was here one day and said, Holden is a Benedictine style. And I said, what does that mean? I've never even heard the word. And she said, corporate singing and worship, matins, vespers, everyone included. People obviously enjoy their work here. She said, that's the first thing I noticed. The kitchen enjoyed their work. The Mavericks enjoyed their work. The guests pitch in and work. There's not a distinction between paying guests and paid staff. She said, work has a very high... The sessions and the study is a very important part of it. Every room has some piece of art, and most of it was created here. It's fabric art or it's ceramic art. It's not aesthetic to where your room looks like a cell. It looks moderation and simplicity, but a possible piece of beauty in each room, and usually created here and not bought somewhere else. She went through, and I said, well, if that's Benedictine style, that's fine with me, because I really do think that you've described something about Holden. But they had a particular focus. Another way to say that, orders existed to hold up in an age that seemed to have forsaken or rejected a particular beatitude. The orders existed to hold up that beatitude so it didn't get lost. Franciscans, an age of materialism, hold up the beatitude of blessed are the poor, or blessed are the poor in spirit, depending upon Luke or Matthew. But the value of poverty in a world that had gone way too far in terms of materialism. Henry Nouwen says, obviously today, the beatitude to hold up is blessed are the peacemakers in a world that is militaristic. Militarism is so much part of our world that we could just lose the beatitude, blessed are the peacemakers. But they had a particular focus to it. Three, they had some kind of rule, some description of a common lifestyle. Maybe the way to say this is orders had more common lifestyle than they did common ministry. What brought them together was a common way of life more than a particular apostolate or a particular job to do. Some missionary societies form around a particular job. The orders formed more around their style of life, their style of worship, their style of daily spirituality. But they all had that as one of the distinctive marks, a common spirituality, no matter what else they did. Four, they all made some kind of vows. And I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of switching and go to the very back page when it came folded with a little description of the vows. This is probably the greatest hesitation that people would have, especially Protestants, if you talked about orders. Poverty, celibacy, and obedience. No way. Right? Does that sell most places that you... Let me just tell you that there is some historical reason to question the essence of the vows, and certainly some things going on today in regard to the vows. If you could envision that the vow of celibacy was primarily, essentially, a vow of availability, does that put a different connotation on it? In other words, I don't think historically that you can substantiate. I think historically one of the vows, the reason for the vow of celibacy was an understanding of the evilness of sex, probably especially anti-woman as far as the first vow. I simply think that's part of the vow. But Sister Maria Agustiniel and some others have pointed out that if you wanted a way in which the vows were evangelical and understood gospel values and got rid of some of the baggage that we certainly are trying to get rid of in regard to human sexuality, male, female, and other issues, if it was primarily availability, that some people would say, for the sake of the whole church and for the sake of my being able to be free for people who need me, I will forego family obligations. They are competing values on one's time, are they not? So see that the possibility that for the sake of the church, for the sake of someone's vocation and call as a free choice, some people might vow availability. Poverty. I think there is better historic precedence that the vow of poverty was first of all a vow of sharing. The negative part, especially Protestants pick this up immediately, the negative part of the vow of poverty was asceticism, that the things of the world, the stuff of the world is evil, and the farther you get away from it, the more spiritual you are. And that I'm just as eager to reject as you. But if the vow was primarily a vow of sharing, then what you're doing is getting rid of some of the tremendous social pressure in the United States of the right of personal property. And I think that's a very legitimate place for the church to be discussing something. Third, the vow of obedience. The vow of obedience should be, as far as we understand Jesus as the norm, should be a vow to the gospel, the words of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, and what have you, not to any particular spiritual head, an abbot or a mother superior or something. When Sister Maria Agustiniel gave me these three, she says, just look, if those were at the heart, just look how quickly they got turned. If the vow of celibacy was primarily the vow of availability, just assume it was, how long did it take until the least available person in the whole area was the cloistered monk or nun? That was the one you could never get to at all. There was no availability whatsoever. If the vow of poverty was sharing, look how soon in the descriptions of how the orders live that you had to go to the abbot with permission to give away anything, and you had by law to receive anything that someone offered you. It was exactly 180 degrees away from sharing. And the vow of obedience became obedience to a particular human being, even if that person asked you to do something that violated the law of Christ. So all I'm saying is the people who are talking about vows understand historically that they have not always been evangelical or what we would like them to be. I visited with Parker Palmer at Pendle Hill one time, and we had not seen one another for 15 years. And here we were on the same journey, miles apart and had not touched, and he was coming at new monasticism. By the way, his new book is going to be called The Monastic Heart. He was coming at it from Quaker queries. Quakers get at things by asking questions. They don't get at things from starting with dogma that was accepted in the 16th century and now we apply. They start with asking questions. And he had found that if you're with a group of people, it won't take long until someone says, "What about me and all this stuff around?" And then you're talking about the vow of poverty, or you're talking about the same issue that the vow talked about. What about me and my sexuality? You're talking about the vow of celibacy. And what about me and authority in my life? You're talking about the vow of obedience. He had come at it from a different tradition, but we had a great hour's conversation because we had been talking about things in the same way. Anyway, that's a very brief introduction into historic and current conversation on vows. Five, a network. This is back to the six basic characteristics. Because of a similar spiritual formation and because of a very close sense of community, there is a support system in the religious orders that we do not have anywhere in Protestantism that I know of. And I think sometimes we were talking yesterday about staying in the global justice struggles. Part of that is you need a network to support you. Mary tonight will have a forum on where do you get your nurture. Some of that, for most of us, is being with a group of people who support us. And I wish we could connect more. What's it like to be in Tanzania? What does the mission board do in the way of support for people who are in tough places? It seems to me that as you see Marian Knowles get 3 months off and someone take their place and have a spiritual formation that has sisters or brothers in the faith that are part of a strong core, that most of us need that, and that for the sake of the mission of the church, we need that. Six. This is the one most distinctive part of religious orders over against Protestant expressions. I used Lutheran Peace Fellowship before. Let's say there's a group of Lutherans interested in the peace issue. Join Lutheran Peace Fellowship. But it is not accountable to the church, recognized by the church. It has the name Lutheran because the people who belong to it are Lutheran. It does not affect the budget of the American Lutheran Church. Has no way to speak at a convention of the American Lutheran Church unless one of its members happened to be selected as a delegate. You see that the president of the American Lutheran Church at any time can say, Lutheran Peace Fellowship is an independent Lutheran group. They do not speak for the Lutheran Church. So that the freedom that we have also means that when you do something to hold up a particular beatitude, you may not affect the church Catholic at all. What I'm saying is the orders let the church be more Catholic, small c, than Protestantism can be, because you keep kind of spinning off the people who would be a loyal protest movement. They leave. They start a new denomination. They are in an independent group, and they talk with one another. They continue to convince the convinced at their meetings of Lutheran Peace Fellowship or whatever other group it is. But there is not that accountability and responsibility, but a measure of freedom. There's a beautiful story about how the Franciscans, Order of Friars Minor, first got recognized. St. Francis and a couple of the other of that order went to see the Pope. And they asked to be recognized as a religious order. And he looked at them. They were so disheveled and crummy looking that His Holiness said, the only thing I think you should do is feed the pigs. And they all walked out. And I don't know how many days later, a week or something, they came back and said, we have done that. That's what they did for a week, feed the pigs. The Pope said to do that. And they asked again. And it was some counselor to the Pope, I forget his name, who said after a while, Your Holiness, if we do not accept them, do we not publicly say that one cannot live the way our Lord taught? Are we not a little bit on the spot? Are not their values very much at the heart of the Sermon on the Mount? So the Order of Friars Minor came into the Church Catholic with a process of judgment upon whether or not they were a self-interest group or whether they were holding up a beatitude of Christ. And obviously, one of the first reactions you get from Protestantism, it'll be a new lobby, it'll be a new way in which those with a special interest will lobby and have a title for themselves, religious order. So you'd have to have the same process of evaluation and discernment as any other group that comes into the church. But I think this is what's missing in the Protestantism. Second's going to have to be very brief. That's what could we gain There are 4 points there. You can read those. Let me just briefly say a word about each one. I think we could gain an emphasis on spirituality that we do not presently have in Protestantism. I'm hoping this week at Holden gives you some sense through this circle and through an understanding of what spiritual development and other things might mean, that there could be a healthy emphasis on forms of spirituality that we presently do not have, because the orders always brought that. And I think that's the primary thing that Robert Wilkins said in this article that I read at the beginning. An affirmation of existing ministries. Anybody here a director of Christian Ed, or a deaconess, or a youth worker in a church? Or my experience, if you talk to those folks, is they really do feel like second-class citizens. We affirm publicly clergy, ordained clergy. We do it with good seminaries, with a rite of ordination, with distinctive garb, if you want to wear it, backward collar and other things. We do not in any similar way affirm other ministries. And I think orders are a possible way to do that. I visited with one seminary. Most seminaries have not been very interested in this, by the way. I visited with one seminary, and the dean of the seminary said, "I can't believe seminaries are not interested in your discovery probe." Anybody who's been at a seminary, and he's been at one 25 years, would say a third of the present class has a religious vocation, has a calling, but I don't think it's to parish ministry. And I don't know what's going to happen when they graduate. But they have a religious call, and they're not going to fit as a parish pastor. But they've come to seminary because that's really the only way that we have said you do have an authentic religious call, and the church is going to affirm that. We don't have any other way to do that. Closest we have now is deaconesses. And I have visited with both the LCA and with LDA, Lutheran Deaconess Association of America. They're in an interesting spot. Missouri Synod kind of kicked them out. They've started their own kind of new. And so LDA has a history, has its own funds, has 350 women who've come through the same spiritual formation, puts deaconesses or sisters in ministry, and would be kind of free to offer itself to the new church as our first religious order. They really have, and Louise Williams, the head of it, is a very fine person, and she has spent time at St. Benedict's at Erie, Pennsylvania, with Sister Joan Chittister and Mary Lou Kanaki and some other people. So that would be the closest we have. Three, an expansion of the concept of vocation. We've done a very good job of going one direction and saying, Luther's words were the janitor sweeping or the scrub woman on her knees or whatever else he said, works to the glory of God as much as the priest on knees praying. We have not gone the other direction and have said perhaps someone has a vocation to be a contemplative. And I think religious orders could perhaps confirm that. I don't know how many have that real vocation. There is one Lutheran monastery, by the way. It's St. Augustine's in Michigan. I think I have it on the back. Yeah, it's number 6 on the back. And I visited there, and I said, well, how are things going? He said, our major problem is anybody who does come with some interest, it's very clear very quickly that what they're interested in is playing monk. That they really don't have a genuine call to a monastery. And so most of the people who come, it would be kind of faddish. I know of one person in my life who has a call to be a monk. And I think he probably will be baptized and join the Roman Catholic Church because there's just no place really for him to fulfill that call. But I have not met many where I felt that was a call. But at least it expands the possibility of vocation. And the fourth one, support and solidarity, I talked about a little bit when I talked about Marinoles in Guatemala or other places, a sense of esprit de corps and that kind of thing. Lastly, I'm just going to point to a few of the things. There is a list of 10 points. Some of them are particular places or groups. And you can ask me about specifics at lunch or afterwards on some of the ones, or you can write to them. That's the reason I handed this out. I just want you to know that there are some things moving in different denominations and in different countries. Let me
Let me share this with you. I don't know whether to sit or stand. I can't see you well. There was a study of, I think it was basically peace movement in Europe, and maybe especially Germany and France. And this is the end of a long report, and I just brought the last part to save a little weight in my suitcase as I came to hold it. At the beginning of our report, we told how our points of departure were the doubts and the fruitless protests of the peace movement here. Where are alternatives live, we had asked. The communities that are alive have made a link to the ancient tradition of monastic orders. But here are the differences. Instead of celibacy, there is an equivalent option of living as a family in a lifelong communitarian fellowship with others. Instead of unconditional obedience to an abbot, there is common fraternal decision-making, consensus decision-making. Instead of individual giving up of property, the orders themselves were often quite wealthy, there is the vow of sharing with one another. I think what that illustrates is the other way of looking at the historic vows, whether it's base communities, whether it's small communities who focus on peace and justice, they really are finding ways in which they have new forms for their vows. The communities which see the common life as an expression of credible Christian life and more as peaceful and political alternatives to the structures of today's world. One, live in community. That's an alternative to isolation and individualism. That's part of what we have up here and that we're going to talk about tomorrow. Common decision-making. That's an alternative to power and competitive structures. In other words, they have found the places where they feel called by the gospel to be in dissent, and so they've created an alternative structure to that. Common property, an alternative to unjust economic structures, and a simple lifestyle, an alternative to the abundance based on the exploitation of the third world. I think you would find, if you had the time to study and travel, that there are a lot of those emerging. That's what I'm calling the new monasticism. Dom Elder Hummer calls them Abrahamic minorities. Dorothy Day saw them all over, said always small groups, always emerging. The clowns of God, read the novel, and at the end, what is it? It's Abrahamic minorities or small groups that are the result of this study of peace and justice communities in Europe. Some of those things that I particularly name, the first is a Methodist experience in England, fairly new. The volunteers take vows. If you're interested, I think the total is a clothing, shoe, and food allowance, and $35 a year. It's a very strict order, this first one. The Methodists outdid any other one on the sheet in the way of a vow of new poverty. Society of Evangelical Franciscans is a Lutheran group that came out of Seminex in the ADLC. And Brian, the one who's kind of head of it, used to be right up over the border in Canada, so he came here for a week while we were still here. Delightful young man. And we asked him what vows he took. By the way, his daily office is the Matins and the Vespers from the LBW, and it's a Lutheran expression, or at least a historic Lutheran worship as part of the daily office. He said his vow of poverty was to choose to live at such a level that some church that could not afford a full-time pastor but really needed one could afford him. And it happened. There was a church that had always had part-time, once every 2 weeks, preachers come in that really had a potential for ministry, and Brian's simplicity allowed him to take that call full-time. And they were delighted, and he was delighted. So that was his form of finding a vow. His vow of celibacy was not to be married for 3 years. He hoped someday to be married and to have a family, but he set that aside for 3 years. That was his own way of doing that. He said the vow of obedience is very tough. I'm the only one in the order. It could not be some accountability to another person at this point. It had to be some accountability to the Sermon on the Mount or the teachings of Jesus. I have to tell you, and this is probably going to be typical of this list, the community of celebration went out of existence. The third one on here, and this has only been printed a year, and it was really a very hopeful one for me because it was officially recognized by the bishop of the diocese in Colorado, an Episcopal congregation,
They were called a special congregation, and the bishop came up with the language to say, you are both a monastic community, and they all belong to St. David's Parish, which is an Episcopal church, and they said that they felt in the tension of being a community that's centered on an issue and also being part of a typical geographical residence-based Episcopal parish, that they found that tension to be healthy. I was on their mailing list, and the last one was a word that they were dispersing, and that the experiment, whatever you want to call it, would not go on. So I'll have to tell you that.
How many are in Bryan's now?
I think there's 4 or 5 in New York. He has now moved to New York, and he was up here maybe 3 years in that first call. And I get some information about some of them live in St. Louis, and some of them I think there are some more now. Order of Saints Martin and Teresa is something that I've been part of for 10 years. It's a loosely linked network of individuals and communities, and we do have some simple vows, and we called ourselves an order 11 years ago now, before I had any of this research, and technically we certainly are not an order, but we chose it because it said some of the things that we wanted to be.
How many of your people are in that order?
We just had a gathering at Madison with 33 people representing the people all over the United States, about 400 on the mailing list, and about 8 different communities of people, and the rest are individual people who keep some daily disciplines and are part of a daily journal that we corporately write with a daily reading for each day and some other disciplines, about 400 people. St. Augustine House is the one Lutheran monastery. Do any of you know that place? Have you ever been there or know of it? A Missouri Synod layperson, 35 years ago, had 40 acres of land and started a monastery, was across the street from a Benedictine monastery, asked to be ordained in the Missouri Synod, at first was going to, and then they didn't. So the Church of Sweden ordained him. But now St. Augustine's House and the Congregation of the Servants of Christ has been received into the AELC. So in 1988, the LCA, the ALC, the AELC, when they form a new church, will have one monastery. So if you're part of any of those groups, you will have a monastery in January of 1988. Nice group, very small, very small. Maybe 2 or 3 people live in there at the present time. And I think only one person, Richard Herbel, has taken the vows to take over for the founder, who's now 76 years old and not in very good health. I'm going to spend the rest of the time on St. Benedict Center and then give you your discussion. St. Benedict Center is one of the ones that I keep in touch with most closely, and the one I have some real hopes for and hope to put some personal investment in. St. Benedict Center is a women Benedictine congregation, and if you didn't know it, Benedictines are congregational. They make a vow of stability to a particular group. It's not a worldwide hierarchical organization like Jesuits who send people out. They have autonomy, quite a bit of autonomy within an individual congregation. This group of Roman Catholic sisters came from North Dakota down to do some things in Sioux City, Iowa, including a hospital, a very good hospital, and they were a fairly large order for a while. They began to dwindle in numbers at about the same time that they expanded their work, and they went up to Madison at the invitation of the bishop and started a residential girls' high school. This was in the late 50s when the Roman Catholic Church was doing a lot still with residential schools. It was just the wrong time to build a beautiful residential girls' high school. They started dwindling in attendance at the high school within the first half dozen years. But they have a marvelous center, 138 acres up high on a hill overlooking Lake Mendota and the skyline of Madison, Wisconsin. It was a residential school for a couple hundred girls and built. Haven't you envied the Roman Catholics, their buildings and their schools? As a young Lutheran congregation trying to get started, the Roman Catholics build across the street from you. We always thought they did it with their raffles or something.
No, it's
bingo. Bingo. But it's a beautiful center. About 15 years ago,
partly through the Lutheran bishop and some Lutheran pastors in that place, in that town and in that state, they became an ecumenical conference center. So lots of the Lutheran missionaries, were you there? Lutheran missionaries were there when we were there this summer for their training before they went all over the world. Lots of groups use St. Benedict Center. They haven't had any new novices for a long time. And the sisters got older, and most of them are in Sioux City, Iowa, in the nursing home or the hospital. There are two sisters left, and they take care of being prioress. And they are marvelous women, and they have a dream for St. Benedict Center. They have a dream that it will be a new ecumenical monastic village. And they don't know how to envision that yet, but they're open for all kinds. In fact, the word village in their description, partly because we talked about Holden Village and talked about a village concept. Mm. And they have shown not only that they're open for dreaming, but they invited Parker and Sally Palmer. Parker wrote To Know As We Are Known, The Promise of Paradox. I don't know if any of you have read his thing. He was the director of the religious studies at Pendle Hill, a Quaker center in Philadelphia for the last 11 years. Very fine person. And Sally is a weaver and a potter. They invited Parker and Sally last September to come and join this new community. They don't know yet how they will take vows. How does a Protestant couple take vows in what has been a historic Benedictine women's order? But by next September, there will be a school of new monasticism in one of the buildings of the school. I have, first of all, I thoroughly enjoy Parker, Sally, Mary David, and Joanne, the four people who are presently part of that venture. It will continue to be a ecumenical conference center, partly because that's how they get their income. I mean, people come, and it's a very nice center, but they're taking one of the buildings to be a different kind of venture, namely School of New Monasticism, and they might, on other parts of the property, create really a village sometime. I don't know. They have a dream, and I'm interested and fascinated by the dream. Order of St. Martin and Teresa met there in July, and we will probably have some connection with them, that will in some way be... historically, you had third order, people who didn't really live in the monastery and keep the daily office and take all the vows, but were associated with it. I think in some way we will probably be associated with that. This is simply to give you some idea that things are going on. There are other things on the list that might interest you more than the ones I highlighted. I probably highlighted the ones that interest me the most from the 2 years of traveling and studying. And let me just give a plug to how this all happened, and then you will get your time for discussion. The American Lutheran Church has had for 15 years a mission discovery unit of the Division of Service and Mission in America. You don't need to know all those titles. The group that you think of normally as starting new congregations, supporting urban work, and social service agencies has a very little part of its division that does discovery ministries. The director of that is Jim Sefkus. Twice in my life, I have been a discovery prober, which is the word he comes up with, taking some issue that is rattling my cage, or the cage of about 32 other people at this point, and he gives you a few bucks and a little bit of travel money and some affirmation from the church that says, that's worth looking into. You look into it and you let us know. I've always called it institutional grace. I'm not on staff. I don't have to attend staff meetings. I'm free to do that which seems to be the call upon my life, and the church says, we kind of trust you. Let us know what you're doing, and if we can put it in 6 pages sometime, we'll let the rest of the church know what you're about in these areas. I mean, it's not a lot of money. It's very little money for all 32 people. It's not as much as a couple salaries, but, you know, it's $1,200 to travel around and let us know what you find. Take the Greyhound bus. Don't fly. We're low budget. But that's how this affirmation of my hunch that it was worth looking into has been affirmed by the church, and I'm grateful for that. So that's what I've been doing since I left Holden, and I'm glad I've had an opportunity to share a little bit of that with you. That's a wordy explanation of this sheet, but I think the sheet will make more sense now, but why don't you ask the questions of clarification that the sheet might not answer while we're together? Yes.
The youth of the world have in essence affirmed this a little bit by thousands of people tenting at Taizé, France, and being with the monks of Taizé in that gathering of youth each year. It's just phenomenal. Rich, and then, yeah.
I'm curious how in and out of the church is St. Martin and Teresa?
It's an independent, voluntary association of people with no recognition by the church. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Are they thinking of seeking recognition?
Well, I have a scenario in here, and I couldn't help but think of Order of St. Martin and Teresa when I thought it's people. You give this talk, and people say, "Who's organizing it? How do I join or something?" Well, I don't think it's primarily an organizing task. So I came up with a scenario that if someone really did feel called, those six characteristics really did feel like a call upon their life, and there were other people who felt a similar kind of spirituality, what have you, that they would go to a bishop and say, we are an order and we would like to be recognized. And the bishop of the district in Minneapolis would have to say yes or no, and we wouldn't say, we want your money, we want, can we be recognized? You are our bishop. Will you accept us as an order within your district or within your synod? I don't know if we'll do that or not, but I think that's the way it would probably start. I don't think it'll come from church headquarters as a new thing that's kind of structured. But there are seminaries that I think are interested in having some theological education for, like, deaconesses or something, go on in the midst of the theological education for ordained parish pastors. I think there might be an openness to that. And I think the new church might have a diaconate, but I don't think the new church is talking about the possibility of orders. There and then here. Yeah.
In India, the ashram movement has been very, very successful in developing communities very similar to that. Of course, the ashrams are set up very much the way in which they are within the Hindu faith community.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, I think that maybe John, you could visit there.
Boy, if we could get a little more travel money.
I'm going to get there by gray hair.
I would like to, yeah. Maybe someday I can. Thanks. Yes?
As you were talking about vows, my first reaction was to think vows in the 1980s, you must be a treatise.
Yeah, I know.
And then I was thinking, well, a vow to me sounds like the commitment of your energy and your priorities. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we don't take lots of short-term vows now. I'm going to get this degree, I'm going to get this house, I'm going to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be to require it as well.
I appreciate your comment. When Parker tested his new book on the monastic heart, and was with people who had left religious orders primarily, when he got to the chapter on the vowed life and how fulfilling it was, they shot it down. They said, you obviously have not been there. And so there's a kind of romanticism that needs to be shot down on the vowed life. But I think it's a word that's worth using and kind of finding a new understanding for it.
If I would have just listened to this first, I don't think I would have wanted to become a member of the order. And we were members of the order for a while, but I didn't feel it was presented like this.
OSMT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was just such a simple thing, although this sounds complicated and it sounds big and important. I mean, and I would like to hear just a little bit more about how it got started and what it actually is, instead of thinking it's compared to a monastery. I don't know, how do you all feel? Is it something you'd all like to run out and join it right now?
What do you mean by it? What I've tried to say...
The order of St. Martin.
But what I've tried to say is, I think there is a new monasticism that you find in a peace group in Germany, in a base Christian community in Cuernavaca,
Join one, then.
Yeah, I think the historic medieval religious orders are a source. Robert McAfee Brown says it here. A model for renewal is provided by medieval religious orders where individuals, not forsaking the church as such, nevertheless banded together to undertake specific tasks for the church that the church as a whole was not ready to undertake. I just think there's lots of expressions of that. And no one of them is such a heavy kind of fulfilling all the things that the word order means. So you just find your way, whether that's parish renewal.
But I'm just wondering, yeah, if the group is feeling that it is something they would very much like to go out and start or join an order,
like to have the option.
Like to have the option. That's a good way to say it. And would like the option for some people I know who don't have that option now.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be threatened that they had, I would not be threatened that someone had a call to be a contemplative and was somewhere praying for the church, even though that was not my call. I just don't know how that's threatening. But thank
you. I guess I'd like to hear a bit more of how it got started in the Order of St. Martin.
Oh, okay, but, okay. I'm not, yeah.
I mean, that's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
That it was such a beautiful thing. Are you part of it?
Are you worried at all, as we talk about more connection with the church, that there would be more control and maybe the same thing? That the Catholic Church has gone through what happened all over again.
Right. I think that always is a possibility. That if your faith and your dreams don't take flesh somewhere, they stay a wish dream. As soon as they take flesh, institutional, as soon as you make religion manageable and memorable, you kill it. You kill it. But you keep putting it into forms. And you keep renewing the forms, so